Please take your Bibles and turn to Mark 14. Mark 14. Today, as we prepare for the Lord's Supper, as Pastor Valade mentioned, we're going to go back to the garden and continue our thoughts on the aspect of and duty of watching and praying. We have in previous lessons, we've looked at a number of things about watching and praying. We've looked at who said it. We've looked at how it was said, when it was said, where it was said. We've looked at the what happens after it was said. And today what I want to give some thought to is the why, the question of why. Why do the disciples sleep in the garden? That's what we're going to be considering today. So starting then at verse 32 of Mark 14, let me read to the verse 32 to 42. They came to a place named Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here until I have prayed." And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be very distressed and troubled. And he said to them, "My soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch." And he went a little beyond them and fell to the ground and began to pray that if it were possible, the hour might pass him by. And he was saying, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will." And he came and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "Simon, are you asleep? Could you not keep watch for 1 hour? Keep watching and praying that you may not come into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Again he went away and prayed, saying the same words, and again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. And he came the third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? It is enough. The hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let us be going. Behold, the one who betrays me is at hand." What I'd like to do is just very quickly remind us again what has happened in the passage before us. Christ has finished the Last Supper together. It has been a busy and hectic day. I might add it has been a very busy and hectic week, and anything I've read speaks of much time and effort being dedicated to the preparations, the meals, the washings, the ceremonies of each day during that entire week. It would be a time that involved a great drain on the physical, emotional, and spiritual welfare of the Jewish people, but more so for Christ and his disciples. And they have now walked about a mile to the outskirts of Jerusalem, where they enter into a garden called Gethsemane. It's late at night, it's close to midnight. And as they enter the garden gate, a garden that is probably surrounded by a stone wall, Jesus decides to leave 8 of the 11 at the entranceway to the garden. And then he takes the three of his closest disciples, John, James, and Peter, and he brings them further into the confines of the garden. It is here where we read that Christ tells his disciples to watch and pray, and his command is repeated. Christ approaches his three disciples on three different occasions, and each time he comes upon them, he finds them sleeping. Their neglect of watching and praying. And each time he reminds them to watch, to pray. 3 times, all different times, and Christ comes to these three sleeping. And as we've seen before, Christ, as he goes away himself, he wrestles in prayer. He wrestles in much agony. He wrestles with sorrow. He falls upon his face, and we're told he sweats great drops of blood. He battles. He wrestles. He bleeds, and they sleep. And they are oblivious. They're oblivious to this great distress, his great distress, to his unimaginable agonies. And many suggest that Christ himself is on the very brink of death. And if not been for the visiting angel that's mentioned in Luke to strengthen him, he would have or could have, in fact, died. So what I'd like to do is gain a better understanding of the circumstances that faced our three disciples. Can we better appreciate and understand why they slept so soundly? Why their sleep was so deep? why one might say they were dead, in fact, to the world as they slept. We are told in both Matthew and Mark that the three slept because their eyes were heavy. Our ability or our lack of ability to sleep can be, for what I understand, impacted by the state of our physical health, our mental health, our emotional health, and our spiritual health. It's either one or all four combined, but all of them can either negatively or positively impact the way we sleep. And we do have examples. We have examples from our Bibles of sleeping Christians. We have Jonah. Remember Jonah, spiritually he is struggling, he's running away from God, and yet he sleeps like a baby in the hold of a ship. And then there's Elijah, who we find sleeping under the juniper tree, and we have a combination there of physical and spiritual and emotional exhaustion by Elijah. And then, believe it or not, we have James, John, and Peter previously. They're on the mountain of Transfiguration, and there they sleep. And it would appear that it's an emotional experience for all three, and they sleep because of that. And finally, we have Christ himself, the God-man. While they cross the Sea of Galilee, he sleeps so soundly that even the storms fail to wake him up because of physical exhaustion. Each of these men, these Christian men, was impacted in different ways, but it is associated with either spiritual, emotional, or physical elements of their human being. Circumstances impact them. Their very humanity, their very flesh cries out for rest and sleep. The passage before us here, we have 11 disciples who are all exhausted. And I want to give us some evidence of why I say that. I think they're struggling here. They're struggling physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. They are, I'm going to suggest, they're worn out. They are being taxed to the very brim of their humanity. And to say it in more simplistic terms, there's little, if any, gas left in the tank when they enter the garden scene. If I may, I want to go back to the time when Christ and his disciples, they entered Jerusalem. And I want us to look at some of the events that transpire there. What I think becomes unmistakable clear to all of us from the time they entered Jerusalem on Palm Sunday to the time that they walk into the garden on Thursday night, these disciples are at their wits' end. The wear and tear of the week's events have impacted all aspects of their humanity. Think with me a bit here. As Christ and his disciples, as they enter into Jerusalem, first of all, I want us to see that they are walking. And they have been walking since they left Bethany. And if one takes a quick look at a map, that walk is at least 2 miles. Dusty, hot, a walk that would take them at least 30 minutes. And we sometimes forget, but everywhere they went, it was typically by foot. They did not have the luxuries of buses or taxis. And even their use of a horse or a donkey was sometimes limited. And when I read my Bible, it is my understanding that on the top of these very hectic activities during the Passover, they were walking each and every day. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, they are coming from and to Bethany, the town of Bethany. And my simple math tells me they're walking 5 to 6 miles a day. And again, they are walking this night. This night, they're headed to the Garden of Gethsemane. They've walked about a mile late at night. It's after they've had this heavy meal and drinking. And I think it's fair to say that these 11 disciples have done a lot of walking that whole week. A week that is quickly coming to an end. This is without a doubt one group of tired, weary, exhausted disciples. The physical exercise alone during Passover week was draining for each one of them. But add to this physical exhaustion, the activities would happen during this special week, the week of the Passover. And just imagine the exhaustion that some of us have after one day of Christmas Day, we call it. And they had 5 consecutive days of festivities. The activities of family and friends would exhaust them. The Passover included a number of practices. There was this meticulous preparation of their body and clothing. They would have these religious ceremonies, the daily travel to and from the synagogue. They would be in this bustling crowds, working in the streets, in the synagogues, in the marketplace, trying to move around them. The crowds that would be flowing in and out of Jerusalem, they would be close to 100,000 people during the Passover week. And think with me for a bit. Think of the things that these three men would see and experience, that they would need to digest in these few short days. First, we have the great triumphal entrance into Jerusalem. This was the parade of the parades. It was a parade like none other. Men, women, children, all would have been lining the streets, laying down what we're told palm branches, the palm branches, symbols of victory and triumph and peace. And this was this not a parade fit for a great king, a great soldier, a great conqueror who was returning from some great victorious battle against their enemy? We read something like this in 1 Kings, where David returns from defeating the Philistines. There, we're told, the women of Israel came out from the surrounding cities, singing, dancing, chanting that David has killed his 10,000. What emotion, what fanfare, what attention that Christ and the disciples would have received and experienced as they make this grand entrance into Jerusalem. Did this not have all the trappings of royalty? They were the talk of the town. They were like celebrities. They were hometown heroes. And interesting, is it not? But most of the disciples were thinking and expecting, this is exactly what we expect to happen. Has this not been constantly on their minds? This was the great parade, the grand parade to start something great and wonderful, the kingdom on earth. Had they not heard and been taught from childhood? And soon, all of them would reign on earth together with Christ. They would rule with him. Why, some of them, James and John, had already been seeking that special honor and privilege. It was all about recognition, all about prestige. One of them was, with a little help from his mother, had wanted to sit on the left, the other on the right side. But things would soon start to unravel. There are a few unexpected bumps on the road along the way, and this is not exactly what they've been expecting. I'm sure they were disappointed. In a very short time, soon after they've entered Jerusalem, there are eyewitnesses to the cleansing of the temple. Not the best way to start setting up a kingdom on earth. I'm sure some of them, it was shocking. Seldom had they themselves seen his holy and righteous anger, his indignation. And it was such an emotionally charged event. It was a spectacle that no one would forget. What a contrast to that grand entrance that had just occurred only one day before. It must have started that emotional roller coaster in all of their minds. And what begins to happen during the week? It becomes more unsightly, more ugly, more awkward confrontations with the religious leaders of the day. There's this ugly backlash from the chief priests, the Pharisees. This is not really what they'd all expected. On top of these events, Christ continues to teach. He teaches numerous parables, we're told. Many, I'm sure, the disciples were struggling to grasp their meaning. Things are not going the way they'd hoped. There's this unusual, heightened, frightening level of conflict and confrontation that's coming from the Pharisees. Jesus exposes their hypocrisy. He calls them out. He pronounces woe upon their deception, upon their falsehoods. These altercations are getting worse. And the week continues. They hear Christ lament and mourn over Jerusalem. He speaks of difficult and perilous times that Jerusalem would soon face. More parables. He speaks of judgment. He speaks of his own crucifixion. He speaks of his return to the earth and then the Lord's Supper. So much has happened. So much emotion. So much for them to ponder. What a busy, hectic week. A week of highs. A week of lows. And the disciples, they would have heard so much. So much would have stirred their hearts, stirred their emotions, their minds. So much detail to think about and wrestle about. And how would this all affect them? They're confused. The very one they love, that they've grown to love and adore, he's talking about leaving them. He will soon depart from them. They don't understand. And I'm sure that some of them would find it more easier not even to dwell on it, what has now been filling their ears. And then to make matters worse, to top it off, there's this mention of betrayal. One of them will betray. There is the mention of desertion. They themselves will all run away, they're told. They will hightail it out of town. And to top it off, they will deny him. They never knew him. This is all too much. Too much to handle. Too much in a short, short time. Their feeble minds, their emotions are overwhelmed. Their bodies, their minds, all facing stress like never before. They're stressing out. This is a tsunami of negativity that has hit them. It's all too depressing, distressing, discouraging, disheartening. And somewhere, wherever it can, sometimes they have to. They have to find sleep, simply find sleep. Sleep allows them, in a sense, to escape the realities, to escape the realities of what they're hearing. It allows them temporarily to go on holidays. That's what sleep allows. This is one way which our weak human bodies try and deal and handle raw emotions. And there's something else here we must remember. Spiritually, these disciples are not in the greatest of shape. They're weak, and we know it from various verses in the Gospels. Spiritual pride is oozing from their pores. Why, two of them have made it very clear, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that they want to sit at the head table in the new kingdom. They want to be front and center. They want the prominence. They want the recognition. And in Luke, we have two more examples of this mindset. We have two more arguments to which they are arguing who's going to be the greatest. And one is so disturbing. One is so disturbing because it happens right after Christ has washed their feet. Right after he showed how humble and servant-like he is, they argue. They argue about who is going to be greatest. They want to be recognized. Pride has become a blind spot. It's preventing them from seeing their own weakness, their own frailty. They have no idea. They have no idea that danger lurks. They have no idea that temptation will soon be knocking on their door. And to make matters worse, if things could get worse for these troubled disciples, after they're soon told that they will be under the attack of Satan. One of them, at least, will be under the attack of Satan. Satan's coming. Satan is coming to sift. Satan wants to destroy. And Christ warns all of them about falling away. All of them. And yes, all of them say with one voice, all in unison, we will not deny you. They walk. They walk to the garden with confidence and pride. Physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, they're in rough shape. All their human capacities have been taxed to the full. They're a train wreck waiting to happen. They're like a ship on the ocean that is already tossing to and fro. This is the sad state. And what do you expect? What do you think will happen? What will transpire? Is sleep not going to be the answer? Is sleep not going to be expected? Why would they not sleep? They have every reason to sleep. It makes total sense. We read in both Matthew and Mark, their eyes are heavy. Luke adds another interesting description. It says, they were sleeping from sorrow. Their eyes are heavy. They sleep from sorrow. And that's the picture. That's the picture that's in front of us. What I'd like to do now is have two applications for us before the Lord's Supper. The first lesson is this, and I want us to give us some thoughts. There is no such thing as excuses. We have spent some time looking at the disciples, and if anyone had an excuse as why they should not or could not watch and pray, these three guys all had reasons why. They could write a book. And yet with all of their reasons to not watch and pray, what I find very interesting here is what does Christ ask them to do? They have all the reasons you can talk about, but what does Christ ask them to do? If anyone knows these three guys and what they've been through, it's Christ. He knows them better than they know themselves. If anyone knows that their flesh is weak, he knows. If anyone knows there's no gas in the tank, he knows. And let me ask a question here for all of us to think about. Do you think Christ would ask his disciples to do something or anything that they were not capable of doing. Think with me for a moment. Let me repeat. Do you think Christ would ask any of his three disciples to do something that was impossible for them to do? I doubt there's anyone here today, mother or father, who would ever ask or expect one of their children to do something they were simply incapable of doing. You wouldn't do that. You could almost call that cruel. And neither would Christ. Christ would not ask his disciples to do the impossible. He would never do that. No, what this tells us, beyond a shadow of doubt, is a fundamental truth. Christ asks them to watch and pray because they are able. Because they can. Because they must. All of the excuses that they can possibly throw up, all the buts, all of the I can't, simply are not enough and do not allow them to sleep. He tells them, he expects them to watch and pray, knowing full well that there are no excuses for them. As hard as it was for them, they can, they should, they must watch and pray. And when it comes back to you and I, it does come back to us. Likewise, it's the same for us. The lesson here is very simple. If those three disciples were expected to watch and pray under the worst of the worst circumstances, surely that means you and I must watch and pray. We must not throw up flimsy excuses that would keep us from this fundamental, this important Christian duty. We must watch and pray. And finally, as we prepare for the table, I want to look and focus on Christ. I want to ask some questions. Is Christ not physically exhausted? Would he not be more exhausted than all the other three? Is Christ not more mentally, emotionally, and spiritually exhausted than all of the other three? Let me continue with my question. Who cleanses the temple? Who does all the arguing with the religious leaders of the day? Who is also walking 5 miles a day? Who is being betrayed and denied? Who is the only one who peers into the cup of wrath and sin? Who is the only one who sees and understands the horrors of the cup? Who is the one who knew that he was about to be abandoned and forsaken by his father? Who knows that? Who knew the number of lashes that would fall upon his back? Who knew the number of times that his face and body would be punched and pummeled? Who knew the number of times that he would be spit upon? Who knew the exact number of times that hammer would pound each of those nails, those spikes, into his hands? Who knew the number of times that he would push up on his legs just to get one more breath? You know who knew? Christ knew. He knew every last, every detail, and he knew every drop of torment that was going to fall upon him. And Christ, knowing all of this, would it not cause him to suffer unimaginable sorrow, unimaginable grief, beyond our human comprehension? We are told in the Gospels that he was distressed and troubled. We're told that he was grieved to death. We're told he's in agony, he's in sorrow. We're told he sweats great drops of blood. No one in the garden, no one, let me take that even further, no one in all of human history, no one in all of human history has been or ever will be more physically, emotionally, mentally, or spiritually exhausted than when Christ was in that garden. Except maybe the cross. And yet, what does he do? What does he do? In the midst of this ocean of sorrows and grief that encompass him, they engulf him, what does he do? He battles. He watches. He prays. And he does it. He does it when every fiber in his being, every fiber of his humanity, wants to push that hideous cup away, push it as far away as possible. That's what every fiber in his being is crying out to do. You and I are able to come to this table because of what Christ did and what he accomplished in the garden. Christ watched and Christ prayed. And by his watching and praying, he overcame the weaknesses of his humanity. He overcame his weak flesh. And he submitted himself to the will of his Father. Yet not what I will, but what you will, he says. These are the very words he spoke as he accepted, as he held, as he looked into that cup while in the garden. And he went on to drink from that cup. He went on to drink every drop that filled that loathsome cup. And he went to the cross for you and I. Please take your red hymnals, your red